Hey there, welcome back to Millennial Musings. And as always, I'm your host, Anurag. Today's episode is topic-centric, and it's going to focus on the escalating conflict between India and Pakistan. For a topic that has so many nuances to it and such various factors that affect it, I felt like I had to call upon one of my closest and reliable friends, Shalaj Lawania, for the discussion. We don't always agree on every issue, and in fact, we have very different thought processes. But that is fundamentally why he is the first person I turn to break down an important happening in our world today. For such a crucial discussion, I couldn't be more excited to have Shalaj on board. So let's welcome him to Millennial Musings. What's up, bro? Welcome to Millennial Musings. This is your first, I believe, your first foray into my podcast. Although we've recorded other stuff before, which we can't talk about yet.
Yeah, I mean, even though we have retroactively, I mean, we can comment on it. I must say it's an honor and a privilege to be a part of Millennial Musings. Ever I was a young child, I've been listening to your podcast. So it is a childhood dream that's come true for me.
I'm glad that throughout your childhood, you've been listening to my four episodes. It means a lot to me.
I grew up listening to you. And now I'm on the opposite end of this microphone. It's surreal. I must thank all the stars that aligned that got me here.
Oh, I mean, truly, it's an honor that I'm able to bring a fan on board. but anyway, this podcast was created with the idea that not only do we focus on people, but also on issues, right? And you and I have, over the last couple of weeks at least, been focusing on something that's really, really blowing up and taking all of our attention, at least in the subcontinent. And that is the situation between India and Pakistan. As we know, on 14th February, there was an attack on the Central Reserve Police Force of India, which led to about 40 deaths. And it was done by what is claimed to be a Jaish-e-Mohammed terrorist by the name of Adil Ahmed. And what it has resulted to is almost like a diplomatic and military standoff between these two nations, between these two nuclear nations, nuclear-powered nations. And there are just a lot of dynamics about it that we've been discussing in person, which I wanted to actually focus on today's topic. And what I want to start with is that, like, on a general scale and general level, what are your thoughts about what's going on? There's just so much to unpack. There's just so much tension, and what's your general feeling about everything that's been going on between India and Pakistan?
So initially, when this happened, there were two things that immediately struck out to me, and those were that, okay, clearly, as you stated the facts, there was a terrorist attack. Right, and it has been, I mean, it has been acknowledged by them, so there's no guesswork involved aspect at all. So we clearly have, let's say, an action that performed and a perpetrator for it. And I mean, I would assume that universally we are all just on the same page when it comes to terrorism, in the fact that we can label it as malicious. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even though I take arguments that say that, sure, there's a level of brainwashing involved and there's a certain amount of influence within those militant and extremist groups, I don't think that justifies anyone's tendency to take any life.
Right.
And that's where I would put my foot down. So no matter what your level of brainwashing is, it just cannot justify you deciding to bomb people up, you know?
Correct.
And that's either tantamount to like a mental illness of some sort, so that has to be eradicated in the form of whatever rehabilitation or medication of some sort, mm-hmm. or is a sane mind's ideology, which is just plain evil, then, right?
So
which
right,
is
like it's
at the end of the day,
it's things pushed to the extreme, right? And that's why we call them as extremist groups as well. But
yeah.
There's a lot more nuance to it, obviously, and I think to understand exactly where we take this conversation, it's also important to say that after this attack, obviously, there was a few days up to the 26th of February where there was just a lot of talk about reactions. You know, what kind of reaction is India's military going to take? What kind of reaction are we going to take diplomatically? And then we did end up having a surgical strike, as the Indian Air Force would call it. And the details of it are a little hazy, but it supposedly happened.
following which there was an aerial engagement between our Air Force and Pakistan's, which led to the capture of our wing commander. And a few days later, after he was held by Pakistan's army, we had a situation where he was released. And that kind of plays the whole, kind of gives you an idea about where we are with this whole situation. But there were obviously several knee-jerk reactions almost right off the bat, right? If you think about it, as soon as the attack happened, there was this huge situation where, because the terrorist was from, you know, Indian, I mean, Indian side of Kashmir, and or Kashmir, to be more politically right, there was kind of a reaction from the rest of the country where certain Kashmiris were attacked. Kashmiris were being kind of like an anti-Kashmir sentiment and backlash, which is all which is kind of like always simmering on the surface. But that happened, and then we had the banning of like Pakistani actors and singers from participating in the Indian film industry anymore. So, what are your thoughts on like that immediate kind of reaction, right? Like, let's just ban everything from Pakistan or everybody from Pakistan for having any kind of interactions with India. What do you think about reactions of that sort?
I thought it was a bit disappointing, and also thought it was the wrong way to approach it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had to make a clear distinction that we are combating terrorism,
right?
You know, but somehow the rhetoric changed to combating Pakistan mm-hmm. as a country. And that kind of equated terrorism with Pakistan, which, I mean, on just on face value is pretty unfair and obviously doing a massive disservice to the country and the culture, right? So that, I think, rhetoric got very quickly merged in the knee-jerk reaction. And the, what I saw was everyone was just shouting for let's go for war against Pakistan.
Right.
And if you just break it down on a psychological level, if you have a problem, it's much better to, like, you know, attack it, like break it down into smaller problems and then attack it. So even if, let's say, you are someone whose only belief is that the entire country is composed of just terrorists. So if mm-hmm. you just believe, surprisingly, if you, I mean, I'm pretty sure there are people like this who think that Pakistan is just composed of extremist groups.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you have that level of thinking, the way to combat this problem would not be to just directly try and combat the entire country, but to break it down into identifiable problems. So let's say JEM is one identified problem, and then just try to work on that first before you try to take out the entire thing, right? So, I mean, in just as a problem solving process, that would have been more effective. But
right.
what I saw was that people's, because you always want to have a narrative, and I think it's a human tendency to have some kind of a context and story to everything that we listen to, because we merged that story with this attack, we actually lost a way of combating this effectively. That's what I thought.
Right, but then again, there are, and I mean, I agree with you, obviously, but what would you say about, and I can see why this argument holds a lot of value in the eyes of several people. The argument that the only way to get Pakistan to tackle its own problem of terrorism, or its inherent problem of terrorism, is to kind of choke out the resources of the country, right? So you've had India push for sanctions against the leader of Jaish-e-Mohammed, Masood Azhar, for a very long time, to no avail, because China and Russia sometimes have been blocking and using their veto in the United Nations Security Council. Over the years, over the numerous attacks from Pakistan-based terrorist groups, it's built up a narrative that unless we take a strong stance against Pakistan as a country, that there's not going to be any reaction. For instance, some of the more popular and influential Pakistanis are some of the musicians and film actors who've kind of taken over Bollywood and have become very successful in Bollywood, rightfully so, because of their talents. But by putting a sanction on their involvement in this industry, or putting a sanction on certain individuals in Pakistan, do you think it is an effective measure to kind of force the Pakistani government or military's hand in tackling their terrorism problem?
I mean, I would love to be optimistic that yes, mm-hmm. it might be a way out. I'm not ruling that out, but I should be open to all ideas. But
right.
from what I've seen, I don't think that might happen. Is because, well, okay, so break it down on an even more micro level. How usually when there's an argument or let's say any kind of discord between two individuals as well, let's say if you and me have a disagreement,
right.
which is quite often, and let's say we have a disagreement about food, and let's say the arguments are completely stacked against me, so I'm
right.
on the losing side, right? So usually what I've seen is there are two types of people in this case. One is they would just admit openly that, okay, I've been wrong, and this is a new way of thinking that I wasn't exposed to earlier, and now I'm completely with you, and let's work together towards achieving whatever, what we are going to order tonight or
yeah.
something of that sort.
Yeah.
Right? But the other type of people are, they will wait and wait and wait until there is a slight leeway in your argument or there's some sort of slip up, and then would look to capitalize on that small element, and then that would become the bigger issue, and the primary issue is completely left in the background. So,
mm-hmm.
for example, let's say you get so frustrated with my insistence on having, let's say, Chinese food, for example.
Right.
So you end up calling me a derogatory term, and then suddenly this whole argument has become about you insulting me, and you know, how could
right.
you disrespect
me? So you're
me?
Able to turn it
yeah.
in your favor, essentially, is what you're trying to say.
Yeah. So now if you like expand this to an imagined reality, which is a country, which is like a complete combination of individuals, you know, there's a country which has got its own ego and its own pride that's not tangible at all. So there's no way to actually control it.
Right.
If you apply this logic there, then what you see is that even in this case, you've noticed that India had a response to a terrorism and they tried to do a surgical strike back on Pakistan because that's where the militant group was based.
Mm-hmm.
But then suddenly the issue has now become a breach of line of control. And now that's Pakistan's, That's the one thing that we latched onto. So if you go back to, let's say, if you go back to sanctioning Pakistan off from the rest of the world, you try to put an embargo on them.
Right.
What would happen is then, I think down the line, this is what I mean, obviously I can't prove it, but I feel like down the line, India would start looking like the oppressor, which has happened in history as well with other such countries that have done so.
Yeah.
And then obviously the mob sentiment towards India will begin to sour. So we will be nowhere closer towards eradicating the kind of hate mongering that's against India. In fact, it might even fuel it. That might be an option. So what I think it would do is it would take away the focus from the core issue, and
right.
it would then put it over other things. And then if 10 years down the line, you have people who have suffered, individuals in Pakistan who have suffered because of an embargo or because of some kind of...
Yeah,
sanctions.
And they're going to have bear a natural resentment towards India because they've directly
yeah.
suffered under the hands of this diplomatic action. But you know what, I was thinking about this and I feel like really diplomatically speaking, Pakistan has no choice than to kind of like not admit it, right? I mean, if you think about it, the only situation in which Pakistan can, you know, kind of raise their flags or raise their hand and say, hey, we messed up, you know, we have an inherent terrorist problem. Why don't we try to address it together, right? That would essentially mean a call for involvement, militarily speaking, from several countries or country or whatever it is. On the other hand, if they keep denying that there is, one, the presence of this terrorist group, and two, that terrorist group is directly involved in these attacks, if they keep denying it, that's the only way to arrive at or achieve some kind of diplomatic negotiating, right? Like, if you think about it, there's no other way. The moment you say that, yes, these are our terrorists and we've been protecting them, you lose the battle before, you lose the negotiation before it's even begun. And you kind of open yourself up to be strong-armed by India in this case. So I don't know if there is the option of saying, hey, these are our terrorists, we will take care of the situation.
I guess, I mean, if they openly admit it, there are situations where you can invoke, let's say, help. I mean, I'm very less using this term because we have seen how USA's help has been on other countries. So
not to the most positive extent.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, but we could make a case where, let's say, they openly admit that we are facing an issue with extremist groups, and we cannot. I'm just saying it as a suggestion. I'm not implying anything here.
Right.
Is that, and they just say that, okay, we cannot control it on our own, and we might need some help. That might actually help towards solving this problem. That might be one way of doing it. But obviously, from what you've seen in history as well, that any influence by any other country in, let's say, a home country, that always ends up going down the wrong path because we as humans are probably not heading down the right moral values. So,
correct.
And
besides, you know, like the what happens within the borders of the country, of any country for that matter, is one of the very few things that a country has complete control over, right? Like the one of the very few reasons that North Korea has been able to keep its power for the longest time has been that it's essentially cut the world off to any kind of influence or action within its territory, partly because of a nuclear weapon and arsenal that they've been developing for a long time. But the same could be said about Pakistan. And I feel like for the longest time, Pakistan has been given a slight pass because any kind of escalation within its territory is, you know, there is the potential for a nuclear reaction. And not saying that that makes sense diplomatically, but it makes sense in answering why the world in itself has tolerated the presence of terrorist groups and terrorism within the country of Pakistan. And one of the craziest things is that while historically I feel like the United States' action towards Pakistan over the years has kind of been like, it feels guilty for what's happened within the country, you know? If you look back, what's happened was that Pakistan was an important proxy in the Soviet-US kind of conflict within Afghanistan. And, you know, essentially Pakistan ended up training the militants that were fighting the United States war in Afghanistan. And as that war died down and a lot of the Pakistanis who were involved in these militant groups started returning back to their territory, there was a call of like, what are we going to do with these people? Right. And then Pakistan looks around and the military looks around and says like, oh, well, we can have a proxy, you know, we can have a few groups have its presence in Afghanistan. And well, we have a situation in Kashmir. Why don't we have a few of them placed out there? And groups like Jaish-e-Mohammed came from that kind of situation where Pakistan thought that if we train these groups to kind of do our bidding within the territory, no fingers are going to point to us eventually. And even if it does, we're not directly involved. So it's not like a global military crisis in that scenario. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm with you. I completely agree with everything you've said. But I just, like, every time I think of this issue, and so recently, to give context, recently I read the book Sapiens. And in that, they had discussed imagined realities, which is
right.
a country is an imagined reality because there's no tangible element to it. It's just, it's imagined, right? So tomorrow, if, let's say tomorrow India was to occupy entire Pakistan, 10 years down the line, if no one knew the history, they would just assume it's just one land, right?
Mm.
And even the legal system, for example, is an imagined reality. There's no such thing that really puts humans in check. But our assumption or like belief in an imagined reality that there's a law and that will penalize you, right? So there's nothing tangible to that.
Right. So it's a social contract that we enter.
These kind of things have become really complicated. Yeah. So because now, if you really take it on a like on a human level, then these borders shouldn't matter when you're dealing with like an extremist group that's bent on killing people, right?
Mm-hmm.
But because there are these boundaries that exist between landmass, which we have now divided into countries, and then each country now have their own imagined egos, you know, which no one person can be accountable for, right? So
right.
Tomorrow, if you say, if you can just, let's say this whole, if an Indian citizen wants to say that this was our fault, just hypothetically.
Right.
Then who do you actually point it on? If you say that it's the politicians would say, we didn't do anything. We gave a free rein to the military. And if you point to the military will say, we were actually forced, like by the rhetoric, by the mob sentiment, by the people. And if you point it at the people will say, it's just media. So, you know, the nation has done things, but no individual person is accountable for it. So these kind of realities, we are now so deep into it that we are just complicating matters further. So a decision as simple as we need to eradicate a terrorist group that's based in a certain region on Earth, we are not able to do so because now there are so many, but there are boundaries in place. There's each country's legal system, judicial system, then each country's ties with its neighboring countries, and then obviously the superpowers, how US and China and probably Russia have, you know, have relationships with these countries. So it's become so, so complicated now to even deal with an issue that everyone agrees on paper is wrong.
But everyone doesn't agree on paper, right? And that is primarily the issue over here, because now think about this, right? And I'm going to slightly transition over here. It's I personally, having observed diplomacy and international relations for as long as I have, which, to be fair, I'm in no way an expert. But over the years, India had practiced something called strategic restraint, which was kind of a Nehruvian ideology that was like, let's gain the respect and support from, you know, our actions. And so it was a cautious approach, right? Let's quietly build our military, and we'll have the force if necessary, but we're really not going to attack. It was kind of seen when the parliament attacks in 2001 and the 2008 Mumbai attacks. We really didn't have any military action against Pakistan, JEM, Lashkar-e-Taiba, and all these kind of groups. But we saw a big change in 2016 with obviously the very first surgical strike that was completed right after the Uri attacks, which ended up the deaths of about 23, I think, officers. Excuse me. So now we've arrived at a situation in which there is potential for a reaction, and there is reactions that are happening militarily. Yet sometimes I feel like we are not considering, and when I say we, I'm talking about the powers that be and the people in power that make these decisions. I feel like there's a lack of thought on what the consequences might be. I think we got away with the first surgical strike, and I think it was needed. It was important to put the foot forward and say that we are not going to take this shit anymore. Mm-hmm. However, what I felt like the kind of cheering that I was seeing on media, and kind of a gross cheering for war that kind of like, I just wanted to puke seeing that kind of sentiment from so many individuals, be it politicians, business people, regular civilians, anybody. I feel like we forget that actions like those, which are fundamentally, can alter the course of like a country's future even. And so I don't think there's much thought about consequences going in. And that concerns me a lot.
But before we get into this mob sentiment on social media, because I think I have a lot to say about that. I just want to ask you, so do you think the retaliation in this case, was it justified, or should we have practiced strategic restraint in this case as well?
I mean, okay, here's the thing, right? I feel like the attack on a terrorist camp in retaliation to an attack on a civilian or military population is justified, just on paper, right? I feel like it's a move in the right direction. However, an attack of that magnitude, as it was claimed, again, because the details are hazy, an attack like that carries serious consequences. I forget the year, but the U.S. initially was lauded for all the kind of drone attacks which were happening in Syria and Afghanistan and all these countries. But then there was an attack on a hospital that happened, which led to the death of so many civilians. And I'm as somebody that is not the first one to yell out war, I'm genuinely concerned about consequences or results like that. If something like that happens, or if there is significant damage within a territory, there is going to be retaliation. And I feel like often that kind of thought is not done in cases like these, when the emotions are flaring and there's a call from media, from people, from everybody about wanting to immediately respond. I feel like there has to be a due process that's done. You have to lay back, you have to think through the consequences, and only then make a decision about like, yes, we should do this, or no, we shouldn't do this.
I agree with you, because so even my personal opinion was, I could see why retaliation makes sense in this case.
Right.
I could be convinced that it was necessary.
Yeah.
Because we have seen even discussion in the past hasn't led to anything, and these kind of tragedies keep making a frequent appearance. So Surely there was a statement that had to be made. I can be convinced that this is a, I mean, it's a plausible argument, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So I was fine with that. But tying this back to what you said about social media as well, the kind of vitriolic warmongering that was going on.
Yeah.
I was, like I said initially, I was disappointed that it was, we were failing to make the distinction between an extremist group and a country.
Right.
So we were calling for war on an entire country instead of just calling for war against a terrorism militant group, even though obviously there are obvious links that can be made.
Correct.
But the most effective way to solve this problem would be to just kind of seclude, I mean, break it down to small problems, like an MS Dhoni style of breaking down frontiers, you know. Just break it down to small targets that you can achieve and that everyone can agree on undisputedly. I mean, on there is more chance of people agreeing on this small aspect than if you bring it, make it a nationwide thing. So that's one thing I was disappointed with. The other thing I was how easily people were asking for war without really, like you said, without really thinking about the corollary of it.
Yeah.
I thought it was really rich if I sit at home and say that, you know what, we should go to war because it's not my life that's at stake, you know?
Right.
And yeah, I mean, the like human life and death should not be a democratic process.
The fact that it took the capture of one of our Indian Air Force pilots for suddenly voices to calm down, it speaks volumes, right? I mean, think about it.
Yeah.
You had some of the most prominent journalists, some of the most trusted people on TV, on radio, on writing, whatever. People like Barkhadat, and I name drop her because I think she is the gold standard for journalism in India, to a certain extent, obviously, as cases like these show.
Almost okay, man, don't make it controversial, man. Barkhadat's going fine so far.
I mean, I'm going to name drop. just because we need to realize that there needs to be accountability, right? Journalists like Arnab are off the hook. One of the highest rated television shows, he's yelling out war. He's jumping on tables screaming for war. And you have to imagine that there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, in fact, given the size of India, people sitting and watching these kind of shows and following these kind of journalists and following politicians that are yelling out war with reckless abandon. And
yeah.
In situations like that, I'm horrified. But then you have to think about the fact that there are people, like actual individuals, that are going to do this bidding on our behalf if you call for war like that. And that's when, almost immediately when this pilot was captured, Wing Commander Abhinandan Vartaman was captured, the switch just flipped. And then suddenly you started seeing people invoking Geneva Convention guidelines, the trolliest of the trolls on Twitter suddenly reading up on the Geneva Convention to yell out that, oh, you're holding our soldier and recording them is, against the Geneva Convention. I mean, it's just, like, I feel like this situation or system of knee-jerk reactions have completely polluted not just our minds as individuals and civilians, but also the minds of politicians and decision makers at the top. And that's the scary part for me.
Yeah, it was, this, I've got a lot to say on this. So how I divided it was, broadcast media was like a separate entity which had faults of its own, and social media had faults of its own. And actually I saw this entire, like this issue escalating because we already have persisting issues in all these small spheres. Let's say politics is an issue of its own. Our democracy, I mean, we can say it's not working well. We can say our broadcast media is not working well. Our social media is already going through several phases. Like even we as humans are coming to terms with the kind of impact social media has. Because
right.
no one has ever seen like the scope of something this massive, you know,
right.
Or this deep. I mean, you had Mark Zuckerberg like talking to the Senate in the US, and you could clearly see that he had no idea that an app he had created to like look up people would become like a political agenda promoting, you know,
yeah.
And it would become like a micro country of its own or
right.
Something like that. So when it came to broadcast media, this wasn't a surprise to me because we have seen this happen again and again. Whenever there is like a tragedy in the country, you have seen like news channels resort to the worst possible ways to report news, right? I think the most recent that comes to my mind was the Sridevi incident.
Where,
and
where the journalist jumped into a bathtub.
Yeah. So it's not a surprise to me. But what I've seen is that despite what they do being clearly, I don't want to use malicious again, but clearly not the right way to do it. I guess this is the mildest way to put it.
Yeah.
People still watch it and people still support it. And clearly these kinds of businesses are generating revenue and to a very high scale, which is why they're still sustaining.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and I think it's because I'm pretty sure news channels, I mean, radio itself had started off as a news bulletin, right? So there was a factual, I mean, news, the history of news is probably that it was a factual listing of occurrences, like current affairs.
Right.
But suddenly, somewhere along the line, people started infusing opinions and started putting a narrative to it,
mm-hmm.
started making more thespian, you know, started put some drama into it.
Right.
And
make it
it's,
more
I think
easily
it's,
consumable, I would say.
Yeah, and it's an innate tendency for people to go towards narratives. So clearly that sold more and more and more. And in the end, we reached where we all broadcast media, where everything is now a mini theater, you know, and there's propaganda and there's opinions and there's less facts, but people are willing to make up facts to promote a certain thespian narrative. So we have reached that stage in broadcast media. So that I feel is a major problem that has been existing for the longest time.
Right.
And I think you've had a lot of involvement in media as well. I'll be quite curious to know how you think this can be solved, because I personally am got a more pessimistic outlook on this.
See, I've always been a believer that you adjust with the times and situations. So, for instance, there's a school of thought when it comes to changing society that says that there are a few things that shouldn't change and should remain as quote unquote sacred as it was in the past. This is seen these days with the whole social media sphere. This is seen in terms of comedians who are obviously, with the changing times, it's becoming harder to subscribe to a certain kind of comedic narrative, right? There's a lot of calling out that's happening on social media, etc. I'm somebody who believes on most issues that when a society is changing, you change with it and you build you build direction based on how society is currently responding to scenarios and situations. I know that sounds like a tangential narrative that I'm heading towards, but I'll bring it back. In this case, when you think about the fact that today social media and media as such has a completely different voice, and it's a beast of its own kind that we haven't seen in the past. You have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people watching a single show on a daily basis. You have the fact that everyone has their voice on social media. Everyone can interact. Everyone can get on the nerves of somebody that they don't like. Everyone can go and support somebody that they like. So when our society is changing on such a meta level, it is important that we change what we consider our, the mirrors to our society, right? If journalism was previously the mirror to our society, today it's time we evolve that into something else. Right? Today you have citizen journalists on Twitter that are able to like look up satellite data because of an app that they have to determine whether or not the so-called surgical strikes actually happened. This is from their own bedroom that they can do this. Previously, you know, you had people within networks that had to depend on experts to get their data, which they could rely on and then spread. So I'm not inherently against the fact that our society is evolving in this way. I'm not going to say that we need to go back to the 60s and the 70s when you had one network and one individual that the whole world trusted with the right information. I would say that today, when opinion is fused with fact, and it's hard to determine which one is which, we have to be able to be open to all kinds of narratives to understand what, in fact, is actually happening. So if you only watch one kind of network, you're stuck there. That's what your narrative is going to be. If you only talk to one kind of friend who falls under one political spectrum, that's the only thing your narrative is going to be. You need to expose yourself to multiple voices because you can't depend on one voice anymore. That's my thought on how our society is. And so on issues like this, I will talk to a friend who falls far on the right-wing spectrum. I will talk to a friend that falls far on the left-wing spectrum. I'll talk to somebody like myself and like somebody like you who's like, you know, who is looking at both sides of the picture and develops his own opinions based on what you have figured out. So I feel like that's the way you adjust to today's society. But I know it's a tough call to ask everybody to do the due diligence and come up with their own opinions, you know? So, I mean, that's my...
I think that's the key point, because I did think about like how we can solve, let's say, this media issue, right?
Yeah.
And the easy answer that comes to mind is stop making it privately owned and then just have one independent media like company which functions like the judicial system. So it's independent from Sony. It's not under the influence of any kind of politics.
Right.
And its only role is factual reiteration of current affairs. That's all. But then the real thought experiment of that is, would that actually sustain? Like, would people actually want to fund something?
Right.
Like that?
Are companies going to advertise on something that they don't support that? You know, like there's a big question about it.
Yeah, so then I mean, if we can agree, obviously this experiment now cannot be carried out. So, and it's already too late, because now with things like Twitter, you already have every user like a microjournalist who has his own smartphone, you know, who can basically record footage and pass an opinion, and then people can share that. And then that's like a news article of its own. It might be completely unverified. Like in this case itself, when the surgical strike happened, someone shared like a clip of a video game bombing,
right?
And they said, look at our this is our jets, actually this is actual footage, and that became viral when it is actually a game footage from like 1998 or something. So we're clearly like too late in now making media an independent authority. So now, as you said, I think now the onus is on each user. We need to actually stop supporting things that are clearly, that we also know deep inside that these are not the right way to do it, because if as long as we keep watching, we keep clicking, you know, we keep reading, we are driving the traffic. So I think that's because now content is more freely available. Like,
right.
I wouldn't think twice about clicking on an article that says this is what Kangana Ranaut said about like this issue, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's free. So I mean, I'm like, okay, might as well, but. I mean, I don't give it the same amount of due diligence I would give to, let's say, if I was buying a cinema ticket. Then I would actually research the movie's like rating and like some critics value and maybe word of mouth. I would do my proper research before actually going to watch a movie or buying a book, because I'm spending money on it. But the moment it's like a digital article, then I would just click it. And the problem is, if it's free and we don't really concentrate on what we're clicking, as long as we keep driving traffic to even articles like these, there is a reason for these companies to keep producing content like this, right? So, I mean, just to be, why I mentioned the Kangana Ranaut thing was because I remember seeing it and I was like, what is the point? Like, you know, who cares what her opinion on this is? And I don't mean...
Let's take a step back for our audience, right? If you want to explain what actually she talked about, that would be great. She was at a, I think, what was it? A conference or some sort?
A conclave. Yeah, it was a conclave. Mm-hmm. And basically, they asked her, what is your opinion on it? And she, I'm just very quickly condensing it. And her response is, I felt like going out in the battlefield, taking the gun and doing the deed, right? So those are her words. Now this is my problem. The thing is, nothing that any person of interest, including Kangana in this case, and nothing they can say is either like, I mean, there's no point to it, firstly.
Mm-hmm.
And it is another way of just diverting the issue away from the main issue. Because let's say she had said nothing. Then the article headline would have been, Kangana Ranaut refuses to side with her country on an issue like this. If she says that she supports it, then Kangana Ranaut is clearly, you know, doesn't understand peace and is warmongering or, you know, doesn't care about the military advice. And if she says like the opposite, where she says, no, I prefer peace, then it's Kangana Ranaut is a traitor who is a Pakistan apologist. So, you know, the problem is the moment a journalist asks this question, the person is in danger. This is what I've always seen, you know. It's like there is no right answer, because there's always a headline that will offend someone and you are in trouble. So this responsibility is not taken by the journalists, because obviously they see a certain soundbite that can be created regardless of what
they got, what they asked for, right? They wanted the views and they got exactly that through that interaction. But whose responsibility is it then in situations like this, right? Because again, I've this is something that I'm still working through. And on a personal level, I feel like every individual is entitled to their own opinion and should have the right to speak out whenever they wish. and at the same time, I'm not entirely convinced that, you know, people who have the mic, people who can influence and people who can create chaos, if I may, through their words, I feel like they too have a responsibility to, I don't know. I mean, while I'm saying this, my mind is like, no, you're infringing on their right to speech. And the same time, I feel like, you know, as an individual, you should remember that your words have consequence and importance. Like if I grew up with my brother was 9 years younger than me. If I kept feeding with, like, I have a direct influence on his life, right? And if I keep feeding him through youth, like a hateful narrative against a certain people or a certain idea, he's going to grow up with that, right? At the same time, you see a certain, like, an incredible kind of influence on celebrities, or that celebrities wield, and there are people literally worshiping them, right? Like, to the extent that if Rajinikanth says something, people are going to go and do it. So someone like,
I agree with you. Yeah, I agree with you on that, but. So this is the issue. Like, let's say there's now the issue of this sort. If a person of interest stays quiet, then that's a problem. If they say something, regardless of which side they say it on, that's a problem, right? So that's probably like the worst time to be a celebrity in this case, right? And I'm apologizing for any comments. I don't condone anything George Key said,
right?
But I do feel for, in the sense that in this question, any way she would answer it, she would have been seen as like someone who doesn't understand certain issue and might have offended a lot of people, right? So I do understand taking the responsibility aspect, but like I would rather prefer that, you know, you don't ask an actor what they feel about politics, right? If an actor is out there to promote a movie, just ask them about the movie. Like, it's not, that's on you as an interviewer, as a journalist. This is the same reason why they ask them about their personal lives, you know, about who they're dating or something, because they're looking to get a soundbite out of them. Now, the issue is that and probably for a problem this large, your answer has to be very nuanced and educated, right?
Mm.
But what they're looking to create is a soundbite. So they're looking to create as a headline, or they're looking to create like a 10-second clip that they can promote, or like a GIF or something like that. So no nuanced answer will ever fit into something like this. So while our attention spans and our content is shrinking, our answers should be more nuanced and should be longer. It's just not matching up. So in the end, everything that a person says is just construed as wrong, you know?
Yeah.
So I would bring in that back to where you said the accountability comes from, especially on the user, because now everything is user driven.
Right.
So we need to start putting a foot down and say that, okay, we don't really care about what maybe Shah Rukh Khan or Ranbir Kapoor have to say about this issue. So we will not just click on this article, not drive the traffic, give them that revenue, you know. And then once they start seeing that these articles actually don't gain traction and people actually care about credible people talking about this or factual descriptions of the issue, then they will stop making these articles. I think that's a simple thing. It's just, but to drive that kind of change, to drive the responsibility onto the user, is something I don't see happening. You brought it also, I want to bring it back to social media now, because we went to broadcast media and came back to social media. There's one thing and also comedy, which is quite interesting because to quickly finish the social media aspect. This is another problem that's, I mean, it's been plaguing our times for the longest time, but it's only compounding now, is what I see, is that there are character assassinations that happen digitally these days. And even though someone who's offended might not be right, just because there's a whole mob that's offended, they're able to drive their ideology, which is getting far more dangerous, I would say, because people are able to put pressure, because it's all user-driven once again. Now people are actually able to put pressure on anyone's, let's say, publishing house or production house, and they're able to get that person sacked, resigned, like, you know, for something they might have said, which could be controversial, or which could have been said 15 years back, 20 years back, you know?
Yeah.
And that's something that's getting really dangerous. I mean, social media currently is filled with people who think, I mean, I'm pretty sure everyone's opinion does matter, but they're starting to feel that if they're offended, then they're right, you know? And then they got this power, and everyone knows this, and everyone exploits it on a daily basis. Like, you see a lot of Twitter tweets to corporates, like airlines or network providers, saying that, you know, oh, I was so disappointed with the service, and then if it gets 10 retweets, the airline is literally at their feet, you know?
Right.
So that power is now back in the people's hands. So they feel like, now they're able to influence even bigger decisions. So to be able to say that, oh, we should have a war and make it like completely a public, like a user-driven thing, so much so that even the ruling party is pressurized. I mean, if you don't do anything, the ruling party is obviously rightly criticized, I guess, for not taking any action. But if, I mean, and but every action they take as well is also gauged according to like a level that the social media says,
yeah,
that, oh, yeah, you need to retaliate according to our, like, oh, we're not happy with this kind of retaliation. It has to meet like, oh, we need to give a, like a strong response, you know?
Which, yeah, and I think social media today is like kind of like a, I mean, the whole saying that you can't please everyone, that on steroids is what social media is these days.
Yeah, I think it's largely hurting this issue because the elections are very close.
Right.
So all,
I mean, you,
all
you did have
are, yeah,
one of the political leaders from the BJP even claim right after the attack that this is going to lead to about, what, 22 seats out of 28 in his state or something along those lines that they're going to win in the Lok Sabha elections. I mean, come on, come on. This is again, back to the whole lack of the lack of thought of consequences, right? And almost immediately, 2 days later was when, or 1 day later was when, unfortunately, the wing commander was captured. And all this talk about, like, you know, all that jingoistic narrative suddenly kind of quieted down. And was channeled towards more of like a, let's get our soldier back, which is very
interesting. I thought it was a very interesting element where on the day we did the strike, there Rahul Gandhi and all the
opposition, right?
They were saying salute to our IAF. The next day, the moment the wing commander was captured, suddenly became a joint statement about how.
Yeah, they had a joint meeting too, right?
So this is clearly, it shows that it's such a, like, it's such a fickle-minded sentiment that's prevailing, right? Because whatever the user sentiment, sorry, whatever the people sentiment at the moment, that's where the political party will go as well. So if
right.
they, if today the people feel like, oh, salute to our IAF, feeling patriotic today, then even the political parties is like, great, that's what we say. But the next day, the moment someone's captured and everyone realizes the human level that's, yeah, I mean, the human life that's at danger, then even all the other political parties like, oh, this has been a clear politicization of our military.
Right.
And
you would imagine that at least an issue of this magnitude is beyond politicization, you know, or at least that's the expectation that I have. And I don't know, you call me crazy for having that kind of expectation, right? But you see, I mean, it was just embarrassing to see the entire opposition led by Rahul Gandhi suddenly turn it on the ruling party for the capture of... But I'm sure if... Let's say the Pakistani Air Force were flying their jets in Indian airspace and we didn't do anything. I'm sure they would have criticized that too. Similarly, again, this is not, I'm not pitting one group against the other. I'm saying that even if the BJP was not ruling, they would have done the same against Congress and vice versa. So this uber politicization of issues of such magnitude that should technically unite an entire country is dividing us even further.
Yeah, I mean, my personal view was that regardless of what your political agenda is, in a crisis like this, which concerns the entire country, I mean, everyone should stand in solidarity. And this is not a moment to really fracture the country further by saying that your ruling party is not, you know, at that point, your ruling party does not be the, it's not BJP, it's the government, right?
Yeah.
It's the government of India.
Yeah.
And your prime minister is not Modi, it's the prime minister of India. So
you
need to kind of support that status and kind of work. I mean, if the people within the country itself are trying to divide the country, then how would we ever aim to achieve anything else? That's all. So that I felt that was, I mean, but I'm not surprised. But this is the distinction that us, we need to start making, that any opposition party is trying to capitalize on this moment, including BJP, who clearly is doing this to, I mean, they're using these actions to gain appeal for the upcoming elections, and opposition parties who are trying to show the flaws in the ruling party. Both of them, they should be called out clearly.
Do you think a reaction of such magnitude from political leaders would have happened if this was an off cycle, like non-election cycle? Be it the attack, be it the speeches that have been given on either side and whatnot, do you think it would still have happened?
That's a good question. I definitely think that it wouldn't have escalated so quickly.
Mm.
And the emotions wouldn't, I mean, at least the rhetoric that the like politicians would have given out wouldn't have been so passionate or so emotionally driven. It would have been more calculated, I think, because there's no deadline that they were trying to reach. It would have been a proper strategic move, maybe with discussions, maybe with not, I'm not sure. But the reason for haste was, I personally thought it was because with the upcoming elections, someone, they had to make a point, right? If they didn't make a statement, then that would completely be against them in the upcoming elections. So it is completely driven by the fact that in May, you would have the general elections, and this would be the deciding factor.
Yeah, right? I think I would, agree, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so I
but,
mean...
But speaking of... Yeah. Sorry, yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, I just have a reason to believe that this issue wouldn't have... There's no way to prove it now, but this issue wouldn't have accentuated so far if it wasn't for the elections that were coming.
Now, speaking about statements that are being made or not being made, what actually happened? I mean, I think it's so up in the air about the so-called surgical strike right now. It happened, and almost immediately, the whole country and journalists and everybody were like, oh, 300 deaths of terrorists or 40. I don't even know what the number was. What bothers me is that no one bothered to fact check it. And then until you had, and obviously, you know, Pakistan is going to deny an attack of that magnitude happened within their territory, obviously. And you had on our side, you had everybody celebrating an attack. Now we've reached the point in which we're actually wondering, did an attack actually even happen? How did we get here? And what does that say about like our reaction, reactionary approach to all of this, right? In fact, again, quickly dialing back to media responsibility before you give your opinion on this. Yesterday, you had a prominent news channel talk about the fact that the Jaish-e-Mohammed leader, Masood Azhar, was killed in this so-called surgical strike. Whereas it turns out, according to most sources or reliable sources, at least, that he's just in the hospital because of a kidney situation. That's one. And then for like 4 days almost, you had no one questioning whether or not the scale of the attack that happened was accurate and whether or not this actually happened. You know, I'm just baffled by the fact that we've run with that narrative. I'm baffled by the fact that there's still no information about what actually happened. And I'm baffled by the fact that that is what has escalated within our country in terms of media, in terms of people, in terms of all kinds of narratives about what it entails.
Yeah, I have a slightly different take on this. Mm-hmm. Is that I'm fine with, let's say, if the military bombed the militant camp, mm-hmm. and we killed these many people, I would believe it, you know, to an extent, because in a situation like this, the idea being standing in solidarity with the country is that you would take what your military or what your government tells you to be true, you know. I mean, this is probably when there's probably a war that's imminent. It's probably not the right time to start questioning your own government. You know, you would to a certain extent, you will stand in solidarity with your armed forces and your government, and you would say, sure, I accept this to be true. I mean, you don't have to be completely like 100% convinced about it, but maybe it's not the right time to question it, is what I would think. So that's my slight different take on that. So I can see how, like people started believing it, but the fact of the matter is that I don't think any spokesperson as well claimed it. I don't know if they actually claimed that there were 200 or 300 casualties at all. So this fact, if it came out, has clearly been generated somewhere. Mm. So now it's either from the world, like from the mouth of a politician, or it's from the media who didn't have a fact. Let's say they wanted to publish the story, and one media group thought that, let's just estimate how many would have been killed in that area. And I'm guessing it's 300. Let's publish 300. And then, given the bicycle stat that is the entire Indian media,
yeah.
all of them started publishing the same figure, and no one actually bent down to verify it. So I would put that blame on that source.
Mm-hmm.
And I would still say that I can see why people start believing it.
Right.
Because right now, obviously, it's not the time to question. But sure, there has to be some kind of fact checking. But
fact-checking on whose part, right? Like, I mean, don't you think... So one, I disagree with with you when it comes to the...
Yeah.
You need to just believe what the
so not just beliefs, but I would just say like your first priority should not, like the moment you hear it shouldn't be like, did they really, you know, like it's so Indian Armed Forces.
Sure, I can agree with that, but I also feel like we as people who elect our leaders into power, and if this is the result of politicization is what I'm saying, right? I feel like we deserve to get the truth from our political leaders and people that we have elected into accountability. And it's just an exchange. That's how a democracy works.
Yeah.
And that's how the communication should work. It's a two-way street.
I completely agree.
Right.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I also feel like if there is widespread, unanimous almost belief that a certain number that whichever, be it politician or media, is running with, and the entire country is celebrating over, I feel like there is some responsibility also on our political leaders and even our military at that point to correct the facts, because there's a war happening on social media between people of within the country and between countries, and it's just escalating on social media to an extent that people are being threatened left, right, and center.
You're right on this. I completely agree.
Mm.
So I took it as a response, as in what would be the individual response, like what would be my response the moment I heard this. And mine was,
and that
like,
I agree,
wouldn't question,
right? Like
if it is prolonged belief in this, something like this, then there has to be accountability from like some source that says that sure, this is the right number, this is not. But their continued silence, and they actually promoted all kinds of posts that were like escalating these numbers, is surely a mistake on their part. It's also, I think this is something I would like to ask you as well.
Okay.
Is that now, I mean, very shortly, because this could be, I think, an entire podcast of its own, is that I think also partly the issue has escalated because our democracy is not, I mean, it's a pretty flawed democracy in my eyes. So, I mean, not just the upcoming elections is obviously one aspect of it, but the fact itself that a country is just building up, that our entire pipeline of projects or our outlook now to just 4-year period, the 5-year periods, you know, until the next election. And then we're back again. So there's no long-term plans in place. There's no long-term peace plans. There's no diplomacy at all. It's just that we need to appeal to the masses within our 5-year tenure, and just so we can secure our next term, and then we'll see what happens, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's unfortunately the negative aspect of a democracy, of a representative democracy, where we are accountable for leaders and leaders are accountable for us. But ultimately, what gets leaders to their positions of power and influence and fame, and in some cases infamy, is the fact that they need to appeal to the masses. I am bothered by this, right? Like, I am fundamentally, it hurts me that it has to be this way, that elections are he said, she said, finger pointing, just a nasty, nasty affair. You have, opposition leaders criticizing the former profession of our leaders. You have our leaders criticizing learning disabilities. What is going on? You know, it's just a complete mess. And add to this an international dimension that not only now do you need to be popular within your own country, you need to be positioning yourself and posturing yourself in a certain manner in a global sphere as well. But who's winning diplomatically right now? What's your take, right? You have Imran Khan almost put into the hot seat right after his election with this issue. What is your take on how he's responded to all of this so far?
Right. So I did think about, like, after all this mess, who's actually winning?
Yeah.
And my real
and
answer,
winning in
like,
quotes, right? Like, what is winning here?
Yeah. And I mean, the only honest answer I can say is no one. And but who's losing? And the answer is everyone. Because you can, I mean, if you break it down, you can see like the ruling party is clearly losing out on public sentiment. The opposition parties are clearly losing credibility. The media is clearly losing its credibility. The people are losing trust in the country, right? The military is, I mean, it's losing out in, I mean, it's already it's started to doubt its own commander because they've started releasing videos, you know, and there's the kind of discord and distrust that's been spread around. And the military is, I mean, already come under scrutiny because people are saying it's now being politicized. So,
right.
You know, no one's actually winning, but we are definitely managed to get a lot of losers out of this. And coming back to Pakistan, my outlook on it was that I felt, even though there were a lot of people, there were public campaigns as well on social media, people condemning the attacks.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like Pakistan was, and I can see why they were naturally hesitant and kind of tight-lipped about the whole situation.
Right.
You know, and it wasn't until the surgical strike where we actually breached the LOC. Like I said, they were looking, I would say, that if you break it down to a micro level on an argument, how an arguments are broken down,
mm-hmm.
then they were looking for something to capitalize on. And then it was just that. And then once the surgical strike was done, then Pakistan has a reason to start painting India as an oppressor. And then it just became about that. And then the whole thing, the whole context was brought in about Kashmir and all the past tensions. So there are both ways to look at this. I mean, there's obviously there's no way you can always look at an issue without a context. I completely agree with that. And so I'm with those people. But then you also need to start seeing what's an effective way to solve it. And then the only way to do is that to start seeing what kind of baggage you can keep aside for a while and start dealing with small issues. So the whole the persona that Imran Khan has given out is that he wants to promote discussion is, like, I see both sides of the argument, because I'm of the firm believer that you can't tell a terrorist, stop killing people over a cup of coffee. You know, I don't think that's ever going to. I think they're beyond that level of reasonable rationale, really. But I'm also of the opinion that war itself is not. It's going to be detriment in the long run. There's human lives that are going to be lost, and you don't realize it until there's a human face to it. So yeah, that was my take. What did you think about it?
So I'm going to break this down on a diplomatic, on an individual, person by person level, right? I felt like Modi lost straight out because
mm-hmm.
he was caught campaigning, not caught, right? Like, he was out and about campaigning while the worst of this standoff was going on. And he was tight-lipped about, like, he wasn't talking about the issues, which is also kind of like his trademark. He doesn't talk to journalists much. But it put him in a very negative situation because this was an opportunity to, like, kind of bring the country together under a unified leader. He missed out on that opportunity. Imran Khan played the diplomat situation well. What he did was he waited, and then gave a very, like, lawyer-proof kind of response.
Statesman-like, right?
Sorry? Statesman-like. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It was... I felt like it was straight off like a 1970s era UN politician kind of response. You know, it was very calculated, very well worded and whatnot. Now, everything goes for a toss about whatever he did the moment that Shah Mahmood Qureshi comes into the picture, who absolutely was. So here's my thing, right? On one hand, he has confirmed everybody's thoughts on how Pakistan deals with these kind of terrorists, right? And I'm going to go a little bit into depth on this for a second. What he said in two of his interviews, one with Christian Amanpour on CNN, was that that he knows where Masood Azhar is and that he's unwell and he's at home and whatnot, right? There's no way that and he. On that interview itself, he was like, India needs to give proof for the fact that this happened, that it was JEM that was responsible, whatever. And then on a subsequent BBC interview, which is, I think, the most incriminating of all, he has admitted to the existence of so-called handlers, right? Like what he said, that we have people that talk to Masood Azhar, and these people have told us that they're not involved. Now, fundamentally, how Pakistan has always dealt with, and this is known in all these like IR and intelligence circles, is that Pakistan breaks down terrorist groups into one, the good terrorists, and two, the bad terrorists. Good terrorists are those that does its bidding, or ISI or their intelligence services bidding on their behalf, and attacks other countries. The good, these are the good terrorists. The bad terrorists, on the other hand, are Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, that, you know, conducts all those attacks in within the country. The one that attacked the groups,
yeah,
such as those that attacked Malala Yousafzai. So the way they deal with these so-called good terrorists are that they have so-called handlers that communicate either parties. And this is how Masood Azhar, ever since India released him after the hostage crisis situation, that's exactly how he has been operating within Pakistan, essentially living free, but available to communicate to authorities whenever he needs to, right?
Yeah.
Now, no one has ever admitted to this on television or diplomatically or whatnot. It's kind of like an untold secret or whatever, right? And here you have the foreign minister essentially giving that away, which is a huge, huge, huge thing for India, because now it makes it very clear that Pakistan is kind of harboring these terrorists and have a line of communication to them. What India wants now is Masood Azhar to be sanctioned on the United Nations Security Council. And now you have very highly incriminating proof that they have access to him. So it's hard for that to not no longer be utilized. And so I feel like what Imran Khan initially achieved in terms of a beneficial turn for Pakistan, as you said, after, you know, they were waiting for India to attack and, you know, whatever, was completely undone by Qureshi. And now Pakistan is back on the international sphere looking like they're harboring terrorists that all these other countries have been claiming for years. So it's diplomatically speaking, it's disastrous what's happened for them. Great for India, great for us. But how it plays out on the diplomatic arena is what we need to wait and see. Because I think India is not going to budge on the fact that Masood Azhar needs to be sanctioned and all his accounts frozen and maybe even arrested. And I think countries like China can no longer stand in the way for something like that to happen, because then it's openly admitting that we are protecting this country.
Interesting, very interesting. Before I think we're running out of time, so I just want to bring in two things.
We're okay on time if you want to run through a couple important points.
So one of them was that when you mentioned how things became undone, it just came to my mind when Wing Commander was captured. And there was this video of him under pressure, and obviously they were interrogating him, asking him things like, where are you from? Are you married? What part of India you're from? And what were your plans and stuff like that? And his composure in that situation is remarkable, where he, under duress, he was saying things like...
And hats off to him, right? Hats off to him. Yeah. And we thank him for his service, obviously.
Yeah, and I'm not allowed to say all this, and that was so remarkable, the composure.
Mm-hmm.
But within 10 minutes, you had the media outside his house saying that this is a Wing Commander. He went to school. This is his family.
Oh my God!
He's got one sister. He's married. This is his father. And everything. So
yeah.
I mean, all that composure that he had done was all undone by the media itself in like 10 minutes, and there was no kind of courtesy. There's no respect for code of conduct, really. Then you had even Twitter users saying that, I went to school with him. He was a great guy or something like that. I mean, there's clearly no understanding of how to react on a national level for a situation like this. That was one thing I thought of. And the other thing I wanted to bring back, I noted it down when you mentioned it.
Right.
And I thought this would be a very nice, light way to discuss another issue, was when you mentioned the social media and comedians in particular.
Uh-huh.
We had a very prominent comedian, Trevor Noah, who made a very, let's say, common trope that is.
Do you want to explain that as well?
I mean, so this is how I see it, right? I have also used it to my advantage when I was in the UK,
mm-hmm.
like as an icebreaker, and like whenever to try to make people laugh, I used to also go all ra-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, I have no view or something like that. You know, we sing and dance. So basically, Trevor Noah's joke was that Indian soldiers during war would be dancing and singing and going, "Time to kill you," or something of that.
Yeah, it was horrible. Horrible taste.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So I completely agree. It was in horrible taste. But yeah. This is something I'm pretty sure we will have differing views on. And we've already discussed this in the past. I mean, I'm not condoning what he said at all. I think it was a bad joke in bad taste.
Yeah.
And like very lazy writing. But this is a thought experiment. Would the same joke have been done by an Indian? Would it have escalated as much?
Interesting. I don't know. See, here's the deal, right? The very moment you start joking about death, already you're entering territory for criticism, right? You're entering dangerous territory.
Yeah.
Sorry for the bad pun. I didn't intend to. But it is, you're already pushing it when you're discussing deaths of hundreds of thousands of potential deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. Now, add to that, you're using the laziest stereotypes that you can ever imagine. You're using that, you're laying it over an already problematic territory of death and destruction. And how do I put it? It depends on context, right? Like, I don't know if it matters if it's just an Indian person, right? It mattered in this case because Trevor Noah and his show, which was fronted by Jon Stewart for so many years, is seen as one of those checks on society. And it's a comedic show, I know, but for you know, the entirety of its existence, it has always, you know, showed a mirror to society and has always played an important role of that kind of being the voice of reason. And that is the last person you expect to use a lazy stereotype and make fun of death to such an extent. And then he goes around to defend his joke with, again, lazy criticism of how people get offended these days. I found all that, you know, very tiring on his part, is how I would say it. But I don't know how I would have reacted if it was an Indian comedian. I think I would have still thought it was a terrible joke and lazy writing. But I feel like Trevor Noah is head to a higher pedestal because that's why people watch his show, because he's a thoughtful, introspective, highly intelligent individual that does not succumb to using lazy tropes. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I think, obviously these kind of things in hindsight are a bit hard to predict.
Right.
But even while the whole situation was unfolding, there was a colossal amount of tweets and memes and jokes being shared around by Indian people, right? And that none of those were called out. So this is why I proposed a thought experiment initially, was that if it had been done by an Indian, would it have been subjected to the same criticism? And obviously it was a joke in bad taste. Maybe an Indian comedian might have been rebuked for it, but not faced the level of criticism that Trevor Noah faced. So this is, I think, an issue that comedy is struggling with now as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have discussed it as well, is that we are making comedians and art itself into frames.
Right.
So Trevor Noah is from a certain frame. He happens in a certain frame. So if he starts joking about that's out of his frame, whether it be color, culture, you know, countries or religion, right? Then it is seen as either like racist or hostile towards a certain religion or, you know, certain kind of phobia towards a certain caste, for example. And these kind of jokes are only fine if someone from the same prevalent, for the lack of a better word, group does it. So an Indian comedian making a joke about Indians is fine.
Right.
But if Trevor Noah does it on a predominantly Western show, then it's seen as racism, right? And the same applies to, let's say, black comedians doing jokes about police brutality. And if a white person does it, then it's racist, you know? And similarly, like, say, a male comedian doing a joke about feminism, that's seen as sexist. And if a female comic does it, then it's fine. So this is where comedy is heading now. And the problem with that is, and I'm pretty sure you disagree on this, is because you have clearly stated in the past as well that you want comedy and you want art to evolve with the time.
Yeah.
And I see that argument completely. I'm very open to admitting that it should happen in that sense. But I also feel like this kind of you cannot restrict art in any way, you know, and you cannot start regulating it. You can't start pinpointing things by saying that, okay, Trevor Noah, you cannot joke about Indians, or you can't joke about war, or you can't joke about death, you know. Because once you start doing that, then where do you stop? It's kind of like the equality of outcome, equality of opportunity kind of debate. So where do you start? Who's going to regulate it, firstly?
Right.
Who's going to decide what's right for someone to joke or what? And there's a plus to all art forms, not just stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
It could be anything, like a written piece or like an artistic piece or movie that explores a certain concept.
Sure.
So who are we to decide that, right?
Right.
So
I just want to, like, again, clarify my stance on this, because when I say that an artist has to evolve according to time, that's how it has been over centuries, you know? And that has always been the case. I mean, until when it comes to comedy, again, I know both of us have a deep interest in it, but individuals like George Carlin, when he was talking about, like, his centerpiece his act that everybody still remembers is, I think it was like the 7 words you can't say on television or something along those lines. At that time, that was an absolutely revolutionary thing that he put out. No one was used to seeing anything like that, right? And today, if somebody, you know, uses some of those words on their stand-up act or whatever, it's just normal. Times have evolved, right? Similarly, early 2000s, Russell Peters was the absolute star in our circles, growing up in Dubai at least. Everyone was talking about him, everyone was watching it. His stuff is absolutely not going to fly today. Right now, I feel like comedians are looking at the fact that their jokes no longer fly as inherently suppressing their voice. And, like, this is where I disagree with it. No one's telling them that you can't do this. It's just that if you do this, you're going to alienate a massive crowd. And I think that's completely okay. That's because, think about it, right? Like, there were people that wouldn't have listened to certain artists or certain comedians or musicians anyway, like, back then and today. It's just the fact that there is a growing trend for people not to take certain kinds of comedy or jokes anymore. At the same time, there's still a certain group that's willing to and appreciative of certain jokes, and they will take it happily. For just the amount of hate that Trevor Noah got from South Asian diaspora, I'm sure he got a ton of, like, support from several other of his fans. It's just the fact that if Trevor needs to continue to be a popular and globally accepted comedian, he has to adjust his jokes according to how his popular audience are going to respond to him. That's just the case. You have comedians like Joe Rogan not willing to change, and it's worked in his favor because his audience is that. Right, but Trevor Noah is on a show that is watched by this global audience that everyone wants him to. The reason he's popular is because he's played to that strength of his for the longest time. Now suddenly one or two jokes are not working in that favor, and he's panicky, right? So I think that is the threat that comes with wanting to be a pop artist or a popular comedian or a popular artist, painter or whatever, is that it goes either way. What makes you popular can also completely destroy you.
Yeah, so this is where I think we both disagree. And I think everything you've said is true. Mm-hmm. And I can be convinced. I'm on the spectrum in this,
right,
in this argument, obviously. Because I feel like jokes like what Russell Peters did,
mm-hmm,
I mean, the same set might not be applicable.
Right.
But jokes of that theme can still be done. And to be honest, are being done. You know?
Yeah, and I'm okay with it being done.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is that it's like there are consequences to it.
And well received and obviously criticized, but not like there is a distinction. So just to give you an example,
mm-hmm,
I'm glad you mentioned George Carlin as well, because I think this is where Trevor Noah missed the mark. Was he thought of the trope first.
Right.
The joke clearly showed that he thought of, like, the moment he saw Indians in the news article, he was like, oh, we should do a rat-a-tat-a singing dancing joke, you know? And then he built his joke around it. So that was lazy writing.
Right.
And I mean, my opinion is that if you're going to make a controversial joke, make sure at least the content is good. Like, it's at least funny.
Correct.
So then in that case, you have something going for you.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So that would be one thing. But when it came to someone like George Carlin,
mm-hmm,
obviously the content was good. But you can make a clear distinction that his his material is not based on, like, it didn't build around the trope, but in fact his material is completely built on the theme of the subject. So let's say he's picked up certain issue, a prevalent issue. Let's say he picked up about people using language and toning it down or something like that.
Yeah.
Or he picked up something about, I don't know, men doing something or people in the war doing something. So he picked up a certain issue that would resonate with any rational.
Mm-hmm.
And then even if it concerns a minority group or even if it concerns like an issue that's prevalent, that's fine, because the content of, I mean, the subject of his material is not bashing anyone.
Right.
He's just pointing out something that's wrong. And I think people that, even modern guys like Dilbert, for example,
mm-hmm.
Ricky Gervais, another one, Louis C.K., but obviously he's a bad example at the moment.
Right.
But they do have very racy content,
mm-hmm.
you know, very controversial content. But because their subject is often something that's, that can resonate with people, that people can stress themselves to see that point, it still can happen. So it does. They don't have to really, like, I don't think Bill Burr or Ricky Gervais would ever need to evolve themselves into millennial comedy, you know? They
yeah.
can still do this set as long as their insights are still quite valuable.
Absolutely.
That's what...
I agree with you, right? It's just that my problem is when these comedians, the way they sometimes respond to the backlash, and again, we might disagree on this as well. See, I have a very high tolerance to offensiveness. The next person might not, right? So, like, although we are on different spectrums of thought over here, I'm sure we both can, like you and I have a very high tolerance for, like, how we are offended or when we are offended, and so we can enjoy the same kind of comedy. But the problem is when Trevor Noah is making an excuse for his offense, like the fact that other people have been offended, dude, it's not... Now you sound whiny to me. Right? Like the very
yeah.
same thing that you're offended by the fact that other people were offended at your joke. That's pushing it for me, right? Like for me, it's that you're now making a joke that was one, lazy, and two, you know, whatever, is not well received. And now you're crying because the fact that it was not well received. That's how I saw it. That he was just like, wait, why is my joke not being accepted? It happens. Move on. Right. And again, your show is not being shut down and you're not being silenced. It's you said it. It came on air. It's over. Now apologize and move on. People like Bill Burr or Ricky Gervais, they have very controversial styles and topics, but their content holds up. And so people don't have much issue with it. Bill Burr has been the same for the longest time. I don't know if you've seen this, but there's this really famous thing when he was a young comedian where he goes into this
Philadelphia
Comedy Festival.
Yeah.
Literally roasts every person over there yelling profanities yeah. because the crowd was unruly. And he gets a standing ovation at the end of it. It was on the strength of his content. He knew his sports really well. He went there and he just... put it on the people, and to the end of it, even though he was insulting people, they loved it and they joined and, you know, celebrated him. So I'm sure if Trevor's joke was of a higher quality, and it's not like he hasn't joked about India or Pakistan in the past, he's never had any problems with that. It's just that the content was terrible. Improve your content.
Yeah.
Move on.
I do agree with you on the fact that you can't use freedom of speech as your defense shield against any criticism, because I think we've gone the complete circle where now there came an age where anything a comedian said was considered controversial, because stand-up comedy, like, inherently is kind of like making an impact, punching up, you know.
Right.
You have those elements in it. So it was seen, and now we've reached, like, we've flipped a circle in the sense that any criticism of a comedian can use a shield, saying that, oh, my freedom of speech is being impinged or some sort, you know. And
yeah.
this I don't like the fact that they can use it as a shield for lazy writing, like,
right.
you know. You need to have some kind of accountability. If someone says that there's something wrong with the joke, sure, it is. It might be offensive. It might be controversial. But
yeah.
there might. You need to also analyze why it didn't resonate with the people, because there are other comedians who are making, let's say, jokes about other countries. Like, let's say, John Oliver, who does
yeah.
a very similar show to Trevor Noah,
right.
who deals with issues, global issues, and every. So he's done, like, bits on China, for example. He's
mm-hmm.
done bits on India as well. He does a lot of bits on UK and USA. And every single bit that he does is filled with jokes, you know,
yeah.
And it's filled with name calling and like skits and parodies.
Right.
But no one's really like, I don't, I mean, he gets criticism, of course, but no,
but this kind of widespread is not seen.
Yeah. So I think, and that's the kind of distinction he needs to make. I mean, I thought the apology, so even moving forward, why we brought this up is because these kind of issues I felt was clearly, in the light of the bigger picture, was just a distraction.
Right.
It happened, but then suddenly it became the thing for people to focus upon, and everyone started latching upon Trevor Noah, what Trevor Noah said, instead of actually focusing that there might be a war that might happen in their own country. So this is, I mean, I felt the media and social media in general, how they played with this incident was, I mean, it was unnecessary at the end of the day.
Yeah, agreed, man. Yeah, you have no disagreements on my side on that. But anyway, let's. I think we've been very civil throughout this conversation. But it's too early to say. I mean, cycling back to our main topic of conversation, obviously, I feel like it's early to say how things might play out. It's still tense. There's still a lot of warmongering and on either side, and there's a lot of politicization. There's a lot of seeking the truth. There's a lot of media influence, and everything that we've covered, it's still happening and it's still going on. And I think it's going to be interesting for us to like take a step back and now see how these things shape up, or if they continue to shape up in the ways that we have discussed them. Do you have any take on like how this might, you know, clean itself out, or how this whole situation might resolve itself, or will it resolve itself, or is it going to be like one of those long-standing scenarios? What do you think? I don't think I have a proper answer for that, which is why I'm like trying to like shift this on you.
I mean, everything I say is obviously an assumption, or like I'm just doing some guesswork here.
Right.
Because I think Russell Brand said this in an interview once. Like, you can't bring up a utopian system in like one interview. You know, there has to be proper conversation. Like, when he was encouraging people in the UK to not vote, someone said, "What's your ideal solution?" He's like, "Listen, Mike, I can't bring up an entire utopian solution in one interview." So anyway. I would say these are a few things I think might be major influential factors going forward. One would be that we are currently, I think, at a stalemate. Because Pakistan is like returned our wing commander as a gesture of peace.
Yeah.
And in the world's eyes now, if India were to retaliate, then it would be seen as a breach of like ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, India will be seen as the oppressor. Right? So in this case, I think India would... I mean, they might. This is a spectrum of arguments, and I can see both ways. But my personal belief is a slightly tilting towards that if India does something now, it would be seen as wrong in the world's eyes. And then to gain sympathy would be much harder. And I think that's been mirrored by the ruling party as well. I think Sushma Swaraj has also said that we are no longer looking to like escalate tensions any further. So that, I think, is a point that we might still wing it through for a few months. And then I feel when it's time for elections, everything would be forgotten, because as you've seen, nothing is more important than the elections in this whole world. And then once the new party is elected, I feel they would be a bit lax. These are obviously theories that I'm putting out, is that once it's elected, they would be quite lax and not taking any kind of violent actions or any kind of gestures that would promote a sense of instability in the beginning of the tenure, because no one wants that, right? And they have like, they would have 5 more years to build something, and they wouldn't want to start off with like instability, and like people immediately start pointing out things that are going wrong. So I mean, it would be the ideal situation for any party that comes into power to stay low for a while, you know, and just start promoting their own agenda rather than having a near war-like state in the country. Yeah, exactly. So that's how I see this most likely happening. But obviously, any action, or let's say any kind of attack on any part, might quickly flip the tables once again, and then we might be back to something that's chaos.
Yeah, I've been trying to like figure out what are like the most salient or most crucial parts to this entire discussion, or this whole part on like what next, right? Because On one hand, so I don't know if you've been following this, but there have been like social media call again. You know, now you have politicians responding to social media stuff so frequently as well that there's been a lot of calls that, oh, Imran Khan needs to get the Nobel Prize, which,
yeah.
Oh my goodness, like it's just beyond me. This brings back stuff about Barack Obama getting the Nobel Prize for like doing absolutely nothing.
Didn't Trump say that he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize?
Don't even go there, man. Don't even go there. But here's the situation, right? Like he responded, Imran Khan responded with something that also can be considered pretty controversial. He said, I don't deserve a Nobel Prize. We've done nothing yet. But the person who was able to solve the Kashmir issue, and again, I'm paraphrasing over here, the person who was able to solve the Kashmir issue according to the wishes of the Kashmiri people, there, those are escalating words right there. They are the ones that deserve the Nobel Prize. Now, on one hand, you have India absolutely never going to give away the territory of Kashmir, right? It legally, it is part of India. And again, here legally is quite controversial. And then you have Pakistan-occupied Kashmir, in which, well, the whole Pakistani claim is that the Kashmiri people want to be with Pakistan. And the Indian argument is like, no, Kashmir is part of India and has been forever. So I don't see the situation ever being solved until the Kashmir situation is solved. These terrorist groups are fighting a Kashmir proxy war, right? I don't think they even care about the rest of India as much. The fact that India is the enemy is because, according to these terrorist groups, it's the Kashmir situation. And it's always been, you know, escalating and it's been on edge. And I feel like that, until that is solved, nothing is going to ever get fixed. But also the problem with that situation is that it is such a shaky topic to even touch about. And I think this delicate like balance of like Pakistan occupied Kashmir being with Pakistan and the rest of it being with India, this current status quo, which as problematic as it is the only way. There's never going to be any give and take on territory.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think Musharraf said it once. I think he said that this issue can only be solved when both leaders of countries can go back to their country and prove they got like the better end of the stick. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So once you have an agreement, both need to prove to their country that actually we won in this. Which is not possible when you have a tangible resource like land and whatever.
No, loss of territory is never going to be considered to be a positive.
I would go back to, so there was an Agra summit, I think that was done, I think more than a decade ago,
okay,
which was failed. But some of the main key points in that was, let's finally work towards establishing peace in the region. And they had certain protocols that had to be followed. And if that was followed, then from that, the moment it was signed, then this issue would be considered done. And I think few of them were that first, I think rule was that both, I might be wrong, so I'm open to correction. First rule was that both armies need to withdraw from their respective territories. So from Azad Kashmir, Pakistan troops need to withdraw, and India needs to withdraw their troops from Jammu and Kashmir.
Mm-hmm.
And the second rule was that from there on, whatever region is owned by India would be considered India's territory, and whatever region is owned by Pakistan would be considered Pakistan's territory. So Azad Kashmir would be completely under Pakistan, which would be the only reasonable way to divide this now. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the third clauses was that, and the people of Kashmir would be free to move within those areas.
Yeah.
So these are some of them. And I mean, on paper, they were obviously, it's hard to comment. And there's a lot of, I mean, you can break it down into a lot of ways psychologically or like maybe economically, how Kashmir will survive, or you know, you can also break it down the issues and see what was wrong with that. But I thought that was heading towards something. I mean, that was the first step towards taking a step towards, let's say, peace in the region, if there's a way to peacefully negotiate this. And I think it was sabotaged, this was sabotaged by, if I'm not wrong, L.K. Advani. So it never went through, and it was cited as a big disappointment and like a massive loss of like a chance and opportunity to actually solve this issue once and for all, based on one man's ego. So I think I would reflect back that maybe if people who are listening, and if I'm not wrong in what I remember, and if if these are actually the protocols and if they consider this something to be right, then maybe we can start bringing this conversation up again.
Mm-hmm.
And through the power we have in social media and the channels we have, I would start suggesting that we just maybe bring this up, and if everyone finds it right, start promoting it to the people in charge and make this relevant again. So maybe it can be considered as one way to finally solve this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a solution along those lines hits your Russell Brand solution. I mean, Russell Brand quote about utopian ideas. But yeah. Let's hope there is a solution in our lifetime. Because the longer this drags on, the more on edge both countries, both nuclear powers are going to be. And let's hope that Pakistan takes actual measures to curb the activities of terrorist groups within its territory. Let's hope that it doesn't continue to harbor them anymore. Let's hope that it is willing to negotiate on with the global sphere on how to curb back on these kind of terrorism and activities along those lines. And finally, on the media front, let's hope that, and again, this is my thought. You don't have to agree with it, but I like to hold conversations and even my journalistic, the media in general to the Hitchens razor standard, which essentially is what can be asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence.
Yeah.
And I just feel like this nonstop, like spoon feeding of false information and false narratives, we have to get to a point in which we just dismiss them. Like, give me proof or don't give me this at all. And I'm just sick and tired of all these news agents. And mind you, I wanted to be a journalist for the longest time in my life. And so it just hurts my soul that these news agencies and media personalities that I look up to are making assertions without any kind of proof. And so I'll continue to dismiss them as a consumer because, you know, there's no proof to it. But anyway, any final thoughts on your end?
No, man, I agree with you. I would say get back on the field, become a journalist. We need people. And surprisingly, this is not like an India specific thing. It's a global problem.
Yeah.
So clearly, we have gone wrong somewhere, or maybe it's just as humankind is evolved, we were bound to do this. Like,
yeah.
If you would destroy all forms of media starting today, would it still evolve to what it was within 100 years? Probably might, I think.
Who knows, man? Who knows? But on that note,
another podcast on this, right?
I, what a great topic, though. I would absolutely take you up on that. But before we close, let's keep this topic aside for a hot second. What's keeping you up at night these days? What's an issue that you're constantly thinking about? Apart from this issue, obviously, I know this is also keeping you up at night. But what else are you thinking about?
So lately I've actually got I always was interested in the space and the universe, but it's kind of rekindled all of a sudden.
Awesome.
And I've been reading quite a few books on it and listening to podcasts about it. So I started off with The Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking.
Fantastic.
And currently I'm in the middle of Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. I don't know why I picked People in a Hurry, because I'm not. But I thought it would be like an easy condensed way for me to get
easy digestible.
Yeah, to just like review all the facts I know. And I've been listening to quite a few podcasts by Brian Cox, who actually was a lecturer at University of Manchester. And,
oh, wow. That's where you studied. Yeah.
Yeah, and I knew about him, like he was a very big deal, and I always planned to go for one of his lectures, but I could never make it for my own lectures, so that didn't happen.
That we all faced.
Yeah, so I've been kind of like, I don't always like to stick with, like, if I start following a topic, I try to make sure that my next book is not the same topic, just to keep it mixed a bit. So I mean, this thing has been going on for 6 months, but I've also been reading about artificial intelligence, which is a field I already work in.
Yeah.
With
emerging
technology. You know? So
we should definitely talk about that on another episode.
I think it all fits together. But yeah, currently I'm really, really fascinated about the cosmos. So yeah, that's keeping me awake at night.
Awesome, bro. Thank you for all of that. Until I see you on my next episode, then.
Run for cover, guys.